And so today we finally come to the conclusion of our, I guess, four-week study in Mark chapter 13. As we are doing these studies in the Gospel according to Mark, we are getting very close, I should say, to the very end of the book. And we spent these weeks in Mark 13 because of the nature of this material, the Olivet Discourse, and the great confusion and misunderstanding that has existed about these verses and the parallel passages in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 over the many, many decades and really centuries of church history. But I want to start today by asking you a question. How many of you have ever had a visit to your house from the Jehovah's Witnesses? Just about everybody. You may see them once in a while, but the fact is, these dedicated but misguided people don't make as many house calls as they used to. When Bill and I were visiting Reverend Chip Jones this past week, we happened to be there at a time when we were told, we didn't see them, but we were told that the Jehovah's Witnesses were having a Bible study at that particular point in time on Friday. For the record, Chip conducts a Sunday service, a legitimate Orthodox Bible-believing Sunday service at the Greenville Rehabilitation Center every Sunday, thank the Lord. But I'm telling you this because if you know anything about the Jehovah's Witnesses religion, you don't see them making as many house calls as they used to, and it's not because of high gas prices. You know that one of the hallmarks of that religion is that they have had a penchant, a tendency to set dates for the return of Christ. And I said dates in the plural because they've done it more than once. Over 20 years ago, however, the Jehovah's Witnesses made some adjustments to that very unsuccessful habit of date setting. They had been warning for decades, and let's be honest, they certainly have not been by themselves. There have been many dispensationalists who've done the same thing. They'd been warning for decades that the world would end within this present generation. Former Jehovah's Witness Professor James Fenton, who used to teach at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, said that the witnesses probably won't be knocking on your doors very much anymore because the urgency for them to do so no longer exists. Because one of the leaders of the Jehovah's Witnesses, way back in 1995, said that they had changed their position. And I'm quoting him here. He said, quote, "Jesus said that this generation will not pass away until all these signs have taken place." And that was what we read just now in Mark 13:30. He continued, "When we reflected on the scriptures, we decided that he was talking about his generation rather than ours." End of quote. Well, you know, they say a broken clock is right twice a day. And by golly, this Jehovah's Witness leader is much more correct on this matter than some of our Orthodox Christian friends. I mean, small O Orthodox. So on some level, the Jehovah's Witnesses have officially declared that the world will probably not end tomorrow or next week. And because of that, they may have a little more difficult time motivating their members to go out and ring doorbells and gather more followers. You know, fear of the future, that has been a great tool of both religious cults and governments, by the way, for establishing control and power over people. And as we look back over the past weeks of our study in this amazing chapter, we can see that there are two things of extreme importance. Now, I mentioned the terms eschatology and apocalyptic in a previous message. I'm not talking about that now in terms of these two issues. What I'm talking about are these two topics or issues that are right in the front of our understanding of these verses. One of them has to do with the return or arrival of Jesus in his coming. That event, however it may be thought of, is clearly referenced in these verses. But the other big ticket issue is directly related to it, and that is the time frame. The time factors or time indicators regarding that return or arrival. Let me share with you some of the wise words of Dr. R.C. Sproul, who has written and talked and lectured on this issue quite extensively. And he said this, he said, "In the end, there are basically only two ways to understand these words in Mark 13. He said, one of them is to interpret Jesus' language about his coming in a figurative or symbolic sense and interpret the time frame references in a direct literal sense. Or, he said, we could understand those time frame references as figurative or symbolic or metaphorical, but then treat the teaching of Jesus about his arrival or coming in a literal sense." Now, if that's a lot to wrap your head around on a Sunday morning, let me put it this way. In other words, logically, there are only two choices. Either this language in Mark 13 and Matthew 24, by the way, either that language about his return is figurative or symbolic or metaphorical, or the time frame references are figurative or symbolic or metaphorical. That's the only two options. Now, throughout the centuries, many Christians have chosen to view the time frame references as the figurative aspect of this. And they have held that Jesus used, for example, this word generation in a figurative manner. So they say he's not giving a literal time frame reference at all. Instead, he's saying that unbelieving people, for example, would still be around until the time that that prophecy would be fulfilled. That has been the common approach to this text, in an effort actually to save it from criticism. Because as Dr. Sproul has pointed out, and as I've shared with you before, this Olivet Discourse has been the target of people who have doubted the authority of the Bible and also the divinity of Jesus. Because if you take everything literally in these verses, it clearly indicates that something is terribly wrong. So this common approach to the text was done in an effort to stave off that kind of liberal criticism that Jesus was mistaken, the Bible is mistaken about his coming. But you see, that approach in the end does more harm than good. So I want to stress here that for myself, and please listen to me carefully, for myself, regarding the verses of the Olivet Discourse, and I'm not here referring to the book of Revelation or any other New Testament prophecy, I mean specifically here, I agree with Dr. Sproul, with Dr. Gentry, with the late Marcellus Kick, the late David Chilton, Gary DeMar, and all of the historical Orthodox preterist points of view. That is, in contrast to the futurist view that says this word generation is sometime in the future, whenever the generation arrives that sees all this stuff, we've got to understand these time frame references in this wording in a literal sense. But then we understand Jesus' reference to his coming in a figurative or symbolic sense in this context in which he's talking. In other words, he's not talking about his final coming and the second advent, what God brings about the final transformation and end of all history. No, these verses are about his coming or arrival in power in judgment, figuratively, on the covenant-breaking people of Israel. That judgment came in that generation in A.D. 70. That is the most natural and coherent way to interpret this text, and my friends, it also vindicates Christ as a true prophet and the Scriptures as absolutely reliable. I think that factor plays into all of this. And this is how the early church of the first several centuries really failed to remember or realize these things. Because in the early, largely Gentile church, it was a church that was seen to be always watching, some people say on their tiptoes, for the imminent soon coming of Christ. There are writings from the early church fathers that indicate that's what they expected. But you know, time passed, the urgency cooled down, one generation after another passed away, the church found it difficult to maintain a lot of enthusiasm for the end of the world. But the Scriptures plainly teach about a final consummation of all things. The prophets spoke of the great day of the Lord, the final day when God would come in judgment and justice. But you see, the early church fathers and their dispensational counterparts today, they identified the end with the final advent of Christ, and who, according to many of them, would have to return to vindicate and complete what he started. Now, speaking of that day, if you look again at verse 26, Jesus said, "They will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory." And so if we are to take these time frames literally that he's given us in this text, then we already know that Jesus has said this. The things that are mentioned here would take place in that generation, his generation. Yet many Christians today still believe that, you know, one day without any kind of warning, the sky is going to crack wide open and Jesus is going to come swooping down from heaven. And they've been saying this for decades. And as they wait and they wait, and many get disillusioned and grow tired. And as they grow tired and disillusioned, they become vulnerable to being swayed by our decadent culture. You see, our culture has its own story about the end of the world. And many of us in this room today, by the way, we remember the Cuban Missile Crisis when the Soviet Union put missiles off the coast of Florida back in the 1960s. I vividly recall seeing homes in my neighborhood in Colombia that had bomb shelters in the backyard. You know, people would pay what back then was big money to dig out these things or have somebody professionally do it. And it was almost like putting a tiny house in the ground, you know, and it had these sort of, it almost looked like a, you know how a grave looks when the dirt has been placed over it, has that sort of Quonset hut look to it. Well, they had, you'd see those things in people's backyard with a little chimney spout coming up out of the ground. It was a bomb shelter. They were afraid of a nuclear annihilation. And I recall hearing my own father tell my mother that Khrushchev, the Soviet premier at the time, was going to cause World War III and destroy America with nuclear missiles. And so at the age of 10 years old, it occurred to me that for the first time, the world that I knew might actually come to an end. And I have to tell you, as a 10-year-old, that's a pretty sobering thought. It's a sobering thought at any age, isn't it? Now, we don't have a lot of American homes today with bomb shelters in the backyard. Yep, you know, when it's all said and done, we, the followers of Jesus, and in the name of the divinely inspired Word of God, we do not believe that this is how the world is going to come to an end. When the event described in Mark 13 took place, it happened when Jesus spoke to his followers on the Mount of Olives. We've already been told that that was just across from the temple. And Jesus tells the coming doom and the destruction of the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And his followers must have looked at him with terrified astonishment. I mean, the temple is the central house of worship for the entire nation of Israel, the spiritual home of all Israelites all over the world of that day. It symbolized the meeting place where God would come to dwell with his people. How could Jesus talk about its annihilation? It's like saying God would be annihilated. And so a little while later, four of these disciples pull Jesus aside and say, "Now, wait a minute. You got to tell us exactly what you're talking about." And as we have learned, that was the spark for this grim recital of events in this chapter 13 from which you have heard and read the final section today. So looking ahead, Jesus speaks to them about earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars and famines and persecutions and betrayal and suffering in their generation. And the key to this passage, however, as I've tried to help us see in these past several weeks, that Jesus is not talking about the end of the world. He's talking about the end of a world. A world is coming to an end. Maybe the best way for many of us to understand that is to ask this question. How many of you have seen the great classic motion picture Gone with the Wind? I think just about everybody here. That is a perfect example of a tragic but well-told story about the end of a world. The pre-antebellum South, the South that has existed between the war between the states, the slavery South, the largely Christian and Calvinistic South, that movie portrayed vividly the end of that world. The old South ceased to exist after the war between the states, and it never returned and never will return. So I hope that by now you can see and appreciate the difference between the end of the world versus the end of a world. Maybe it would be better to say the end of an era, the end of an epoch. But Jesus foretells here not only the destruction of a physical building and a city, but at the same time he's foretelling of the total annihilation of an evil religious world political system. And I think that in this we can see both the proper interpretation of these strange verses and how they may apply to us. So in a world like that, and in a world like ours, there are people who stand up and tell the truth, people who speak about the good news, people who call religious and government leaders to account to obey the law of God, who point out what God is doing in the world today. And as a result, they are abused, they are beaten down, they are betrayed by those close to them. And in a world like ours, there are shootings and acts of verbal violence. You know, we've seen just this horrible shooting in Virginia Beach the other day. We have children who have nightmares about zombies and aliens destroying the world. Don't be alarmed, Jesus says, for in a world like this, you can expect kingdom against kingdom, nation against nation. But the good news is that the end of all of that chaos is in sight. Now, specifically in terms of how some of those things were fulfilled in that time frame of that generation, well, in a previous message, I gave you quite a laundry list of all the recorded earthquakes that took place in that 40-year time period between AD 30 and AD 70. Staggering the number of earthquakes that were recorded in the ancient world during that time. But the evidence you see here is in the words of Jesus himself as he speaks of these signs that have already been fulfilled. And so even as we wait for the end of the world, so to speak, Christians are people who have, in a sense, already seen and heard about the end of that world. So we live in the tension between the already and the not yet. Look again at verse 30. He says, I say to you, meaning the people to whom he's speaking, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Now, one of the things that he mentions here, again, I just referred to the earthquakes. I'm not going to rehash that. He says, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will be falling from heaven. Verse 24. You say, well, okay, when did that happen? I didn't hear anything about that on the news. I didn't get the memo that the stars fell from the sky and all that. When was that fulfilled? Well, according to the record of the New Testament itself, it was fulfilled not long after Jesus spoke these words, because the Gospels tell us clearly, and we have it in Mark 15:33, we'll come to that soon, that on the day of Jesus' crucifixion, on a Friday afternoon from noon until 3 p.m., the whole land became dark, and because of that, the lights of the heavens were extinguished, exactly as he said. He says here, the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Shortly thereafter, in that generation, Jesus breathed his last on the cross, and in Mark 15:38, we're told the curtain of the temple was ripped in two from top to bottom. And according to Mark, that happened with the same force as the day of his baptism, when God cracked the sky open and thundered, "You are my beloved Son." The powers were shaken, just as he promised. Now, the clearest sign, according to Jesus, was that people in that generation would, quote, see the Son of Man, verse 26. And all who looked upon him hanging on the cross, they saw him as plain as day, and they saw him in his power and his glory. One Bible scholar put it this way, in Mark's story, the cross is neither a heroic nor a tragic moment. It is an apocalyptic one, there's that word, the epiphany of a new power that shakes the powers in the heavens. So the death of Jesus killed off the old world as it had been known to that time. I mean the old covenant order. In the suffering of Jesus, a whole new creation has been birthed into existence. The challenge for us in our time, in our difficult times, is that we should live toward and forward to this new world, even though it's not fully here. Christians are called to be people who live in the light of the fact that the world has changed. We do indeed wait for the Son of Man to come again, but we wait because we have seen the Son of Man in the power of the cross. We watch and labor for the fullness of his kingdom, but we do so because in the death of Jesus, God's kingdom is already here. But we continue to wait because the kingdom is not yet finished expanding. I mentioned a moment ago how people are susceptible to our fallen culture's eschatology. Neil Hamilton was a man who taught New Testament at Drew University for many years. And he once wrote an essay about how people in our time come to lose hope regarding the future. And he said, it happens when we let our culture call the shots and give us the dictation on how the world is going to come to an end. And he said, at this stage of our technological development, the only way our culture, our non-Christian, non-biblical culture can make sense of the future is through these pictures of some dystopian, zombie, walking dead robots that kill us all in a nightmare. And if you haven't noticed, this is the nonstop theme of almost all of today's movies and TV shows. This is the eschatology of humanism. It is the end time scenario of people who hate God and who have no hope. Because this hatred of God, the present world system cannot know what we know. It cannot and does not know that everything has changed in the death and resurrection of Jesus, and that the same Christ ascended to his Father's right hand, and in so doing has birthed a new world into existence. And so people lose hope. To quote yet another theologian about this, he said, the substitution of an image of civilizational decline and breakdown for the coming of Christ is a parable of what happens to Christians when they cease to believe in their own eschatological heritage. He said the culture supplies its own images for the end when we, by default, cease believing in the biblical images of God's triumph at the end. And so, my friends, the good news of the gospel is this: when all is said and done, God has already won. And you and I are invited to live in the light of God's final victory as a done deal. Now, the beginning of this series in Mark 13, as it draws to a close, I'm sorry, I want to say something to you about what about this business of the end times and the return of Christ. I've shared some things with you during these studies in an attempt to throw some light on these areas of darkness. Because this is a challenging study, and eschatology, the study of last things, we don't have any, you know, absolutely inerrant, infallible book that tells us, other than Scripture, obviously, but it's a little unclear to us. That's why there's so many different views. And so this preterist view sometimes has been taken too far, and people say, well, there is no future coming of Christ. It all happened in AD 70, and all this reference to the final end times has already been fulfilled. Now, we don't believe that. We agree with the Scriptures and the creeds that there will be a time when Christ returns. And so, as we study these things, there may be people wondering where all of that leads as far as there being a final curtain on our world. And by that, I mean the planet Earth and all the totality of human life. Well, let me just say, if you're looking for dates and facts and figures on those matters, I can be no more specific to you than what Jesus himself said, and we've already read it. Look at Mark at 13:32. He said, "No one knows when that day or hour will come. Even the angels in heaven and the Son don't know. Only the Father knows." Now, you got to wonder, why would not the Son of God know the exact date of those great events? Well, I think Jesus is here indicating that in his humanly fleshly state, as a man among other men, he did not know this. And as I said, this is all very difficult, and no one should be cocksure and flippant about having all the answers, about interpreting all of these challenging verses. But I want to leave you with this, on a more personal level, down to earth level. In terms of what are commonly called end time events, there's a lot more uncertainty and mystery about it than is commonly assumed, even as in reflected in our creeds or dogmatic pronouncements. On the other hand, and this is what I want you to take away from this, and this is where this all becomes very, very personal indeed, this much I can assure you with absolute certainty, every one of us in this room today has our own personal last day, our own very personal end time. Each of us is going to die and meet God. So in that sense, we are like those who know that the Master's coming, but we just don't know when. And whether you are aware of it or I'm aware of it or bother to think about it, personally, we live in the shadow of eternity. Now, to be sure, there's no reason for anyone to live in fear or hysteria about whether or not today or tomorrow will be your last day on earth. But what it does mean, however, is that each day that you do live, you must live it to the glory of God. You must so live that it matters not when he comes to remove you personally from this life. And in living that way, it gives you a certain responsibility. It is a responsibility that we have to make every day and all that we do fit for him to see and inspect. So in that sense, your whole life becomes one long preparation to meet our King. And if we would be wise, let us not forget that we must be ready when the summons of God comes to us. And for those who live in the light of that memory, then the end will not be a terror. It will mean eternal joy and peace in Christ. Let us pray.